Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Blue, here is a song for you.
Hey, I'm Jadab Umrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab. We're going to keep going with our show on colors now with a story about, well...
Hey, Blue.
The color of the sky.
Most beautiful color.
Well,
I think so.
Except red.
Nah.
Yeah, you got it.
It's a story that we find really surprising, frankly. And it comes from our producer, Tim Howard.
Yes.
Hello. Who heard it from... Do you want to set up who this guy is?
So Guy Deutscher is a linguist and a writer. And I came across his book.
Called Through the Language Glass.
And he tells this one particular story in it that starts in, I think, 1858 with this guy, William Gladstone, who was an incredibly famous politician in England.
He was 4 times prime minister in the second half of the 19th century.
Every school kid knows who he is, even now. Hmm. But there's one thing that not many people know about Gladstone.
Well, he was a Homer fanatic.
As the soldiers marched, the gleam went dazzling from the magnificent bronze all about through the upper air to the heavens.
He was a deeply religious man. And for him, the Iliad and Odyssey were almost like a second Bible.
Sipping the black blood, the tall shade perceived me and cried out sharply.
He read them over and over again throughout his life.
So he was into Homer.
Yes. And so early on in his career, Gladstone decided to write the definitive history of Homer.
This huge book, actually 3 books.
Thousands of pages.
Where he discussed a whole range of issues relating to Homer and his world.
And here's the thing. As he was reading, doing his research and everything,
he made this very strange discovery. That the way Homer talks about color in the Iliad and the Odyssey is extremely odd.
It's odd?
Very, very odd.
How so?
To start with, he uses extremely strange terms for colors of simple objects. The most famous one, perhaps, is...
The wine dark sea.
The wine dark.
The wine dark sea.
It looks like wine.
Looks like wine.
Is it possibly like a poetic kind of thing?
That's what you would naturally think. But the other thing he calls wine color are oxen.
But it's more than just wine. Take the color violet, which to me, and probably to you,
purple.
Is like purple.
Yeah. Light purple.
When Homer uses it.
He talks about the sheep.
The Cyclops rams were...
In the Cyclops caves as having...
A dark violet.
Wool.
But that's just fantasy. I mean...
But the other thing that he also says is violet is iron.
Iron.
So, okay. Chew on that. Or how about this one? What is both the color of honey... And the color of faces pale with fear.
No idea.
If you ask Homer, those are...
Green.
Green honey?
He didn't call his forest green. He didn't call his leaves green. I mean, it all seems to be wrong.
And this was totally puzzling to Gladstone.
Homer was Gladstone's absolute hero. So he found it difficult to understand or accept why someone who was so perceptive would use such... defective terms, as Gladstone called it.
So he starts going through the Iliad and the Odyssey again, page by page, and he counts how many times each color appears.
You mean like how many times he uses the word black or blue or whatever?
Yeah, and it only takes a couple pages for him to notice
the predominance of black and white.
That the term black...
Black days, black carrion flies, black. Under his black brows, black,
occurred... Black. About 170 times in both books.
Huh.
White arms, white cloud, the white sail, white ram.
Occurred
white,
about 100 times.
White.
Red?
A blood red serpent.
Only clocks in at about 13 times.
The red wine to the
gods.
A
big drop.
Yellow?
Dawn, in her yellow robe.
Under 10 times. Green.
His teeth chatter in green fear.
Also under 10. Hmm. And then Gladstone realizes something crazy. The color blue? Zero times.
What?
There's just no word that describes the color blue in any of Homer's poems.
He does not use the word blue at all?
No blue.
No blue.
Not even once?
Nope. So Gladstone thought, huh, bizarre.
Yeah.
And he started looking in other classic Greek texts too. And there, he kept finding all of these strange uses of color.
Violet hair and things like that.
And after thinking about this for a long time,
Gladstone concluded that Homer was colorblind. But also that all the Greeks were colorblind.
Well, he thought all of them were colorblind?
Yes, that they saw the world in black and white, maybe with a touch of red.
His thought was that they were straining to see these other colors that were kind of just outside of their reach. And then their kid would inherit that effort, or their kid would just be a little bit better.
Oh, so that's how we got color.
So Homer Jr. would be able to see a little bit of yellow because Homer tried really hard to see yellow.
And then Homer the third would be better than Homer the second. And so
yeah,
on.
And then this would happen again and again, every generation, down 3,000 years to the present day.
It just seemed the only, you know, the only possible explanation.
That's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
We know today, of course, I mean, that our color vision goes back probably about 30 million years.
You know, to like when we were still in the jungle, climbing trees.
Exactly. So generally,
people mocked him.
No one took him seriously.
So then how do people explain the no blue and Homer thing?
Well, here the plot thickens. 10 years after Gladstone's Homer debacle, this other guy,
a German Jewish philologist called Lazarus Geiger.
Lazarus Geiger.
A German Jewish what, did he
say? A philologist, which I thought was a linguist. It basically means he studies ancient texts. He finds pretty much the same kind of weird stuff that Gladstone did. But he finds it not just in ancient Greek texts, but all over the place.
Sorry, this one?
He looked at the old Icelandic sagas.
Og svo sem hún sterk, þá mun hún brotna, þá múspels meir far.
Ancient Chinese. Ancient Vedic hymns. The Bible. And surprise, surprise, what did he find there?
No blue.
Even the Bible had no blue?
In the original Hebrew.
Lechuna venivachacha.
It has no blue.
Huh. So, what's this room?
Right now we're in the public catalog room.
I actually went to the New York Public Library and talked to this librarian.
Zur Entwicklungsgeschichte der Menschheit.
Who can speak German.
Zur Entwicklungsgeschichte der Menschheit.
And we got out Geiger's book.
The development history of mankind.
Wait a second, I know this voice. Really?
Yeah, that's my girlfriend.
My name is Brooke Watkins, and I'm a librarian at the New York Public Library.
But she is a librarian. Very cool passages she does feature in Geiger's book.
Let's do it first. Let's do it in German.
Geiger has this amazing quotation.
Okay, ich versuche.
It's about the Indian Vedic poems.
Diese Lieder aus mehr als 10,000 Versen bestehen.
And what does that say?
These hymns of more than 10,000 lines are brimming with descriptions of the heavens. Scarcely is there any subject evoked more frequently. The sun and reddening dawn's play of color, day and night, cloud and lightning, the air and the ether are unfolded before us and over in splendor and vivid fullness. But there's only one thing that no one would ever learn from those ancient songs who did not already know it, and that is that the sky is blue.
It gets weirder. You ready?
Yeah.
Y'all ready for this?
I'm totally ready.
All right. Because Geiger then wondered, all right, if there's no blue in any of these old texts, then when did blue come into these languages?
Yeah.
So he did this massive analysis to trace when each color term was first introduced to each language. And what he found was
The order at which languages seem to acquire these color terms is not entirely random.
First, black and white. Every language has black and white. Then when they get their first color term...
Red always comes first.
Always red.
After red, it's always yellow.
Really?
Yeah.
And then green. And blue only at the very end.
So black, white, red, green, yellow, and then blue?
Yeah.
And that's universal?
Well, as people discovered more and more languages, they found some exceptions. But a couple things held, even from Geiger. Out of these colors, red is always first and blue is always last.
Why?
Well,
I mean, why would there be an order at all? And why would blue always be last?
Well, here's where you get to the guessing part.
Okay.
Guy thinks it might have to do with a couple of things. First, in Homer's world, he wouldn't have actually been exposed to a lot of blue things.
Actually, if you think about it, blue is extremely rare in nature.
Blue foods?
No.
Blue animals?
Blue animals.
How about plants?
There's a few blue plants.
Like what?
Flowers that are really blue are extremely rare.
A lot of flowers that we think of as blue, they're actually...
artificial flowers.
We made them blue.
Genetically, you mean?
Yeah.
What about blue eyes?
Blue eyes at the time were in short supply among the Greeks.
But here's where we get to Guy's main point. He says you don't really need a word for a color until you can make that color reliably. And the reason that red might have been first is that red
is apparently one of the easiest to produce.
You can just take a dried piece of red clay and you can use it as a crayon, which is why paints made out of ochre go back something like 60,000 years. And blue? Blue is the hardest of all. For thousands of years, no one had it.
One exception, the Egyptians.
The Egyptians. Ooh. And they, and only they, had their own word for blue.
So that's it? That's your answer?
Yeah.
Like, it's all, no blue dyes, no blue words?
That's not interesting?
I want more than that.
What do you mean more?
I don't know, something more to say than just it's about dyes.
All right, well, here you go. As I was calling around, I ran into something that made me think...
Hello, is that Tim?
A little differently about Gladstone's whole... theory of color blindness. Call this guy named Jules Davidoff.
Professor of neuropsychology, London University.
And a few years back, he got interested in this particular tribe in Namibia called the Himba.
The Himba. Like many languages in the world, they don't have a different word for blue.
You might think of them as like a very poor stand-in for Homer.
All right.
And to make a long story short, Jules went to Namibia. He sat down with a bunch of members of the Himba tribe, whipped out a laptop, and showed them 12 colored squares.
All identical except for one.
And there's actually some really cool video footage of his research assistant doing this. And he asked them, very simply,
which one is different?
Now, you look at this and you see that 11 of these squares are green.
A color we would call green.
Very green. The other one is blue. This blue one, it's shouting. It's like, hey, I'm blue! Over here, I'm blue!
It's easy enough for us to do.
Maybe it's a no-brainer, but the Himba, who don't have a separate word for blue in their language...
They find this distinction a little difficult.
When they stare at this screen, they just stare and stare.
They don't see the difference between the blue and the green?
It. No.
Well, is there something wrong with their eyes?
No, definitely not. We completely rule that out. They don't see color and individual colors differently.
But then, wait.
It's so easy to say that they're seeing different colors to us. And they're not.
Well, then how does he explain it?
Okay. When we decide to put colors together in a group...
and then give those colors a word, like blue...
something happens.
He says what happens is that now that there's a category for that thing, the thing in the category jumps out. It gets louder and louder to your eyes. The category actually feeds back on your perception, so you notice it more.
You're saying that having the word for blue unlocks your ability to see blue?
That's how it feels to me, and Jules says...
No, it's not quite that.
He says without the word, you're still seeing the blue, no matter what. You're just not noticing it. Your eyes are just kind of glossing right over it.
So you don't see it?
It's hard. It's harder to spot, says Jules.
Whatever, I don't quite understand that difference.
The blue would not jump out and say, high five, the way it does with us.
But if it doesn't jump out to that extent, then this is starting to sound very Gladstone-y to me.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe he was a little right, like, because if Homer had no word for blue and the word somehow enables the blueness of the blue, then maybe his world was less blue than it would be for us. I mean, maybe the blue went through his eyes in the same way, but it perhaps didn't get into his mind in the same way.
Yeah, blue didn't matter.
Wait a second. Do you know where this breaks down?
Where?
The sky. I mean, you look up and there's the bluest blue in the world, and it's right there above our heads. It's been there since the dawn of time. So why wouldn't blue matter more? I mean, why wouldn't it be the first color instead of the last?
Well, that's what I thought too, and I asked Guy about that. Yeah, why is the sky blue is the first question it's that you always think.
Allegedly the first question that all children ask.
Yeah.
But I wanted to see how obvious or striking this blueness of the sky is. So I decided to make an experiment.
Guy has a very young daughter.
About 18 months. She was learning to speak.
What's her name?
Alma. I talked a lot about colors with Alma and taught her all the colors, including blue. We would play all these games that dads play with their children.
You know, pointing at objects.
I would point at a blue object and ask her, what's the color of this? She would say, boo. Boo for blue.
Okay. Soon enough, Alma was a total pro. She could identify any color.
Show me the red object, show me the this. And
right.
The only thing I didn't do, and I asked my wife not to do, was ever mention that the sky was blue. That was the setup.
So one day, Guy and Alma were taking a stroll, and they're practicing the colors.
What's this tree? What's this? What's this? And then I pointed at the sky and said, what color is that? And she wouldn't give me any answer.
Huh.
Although she just a second before was happily telling me that something was blue and red or green. She just looked up and looked at me incomprehendingly. Sort of, what are you talking about?
She thought you were kidding?
I think she didn't understand what I was on about.
Huh.
In retrospect, there was no object there. There was nothing with color for her.
You're just pointing into the void, basically.
Pointing into nothingness. So she wouldn't say anything.
But Guy kept asking every single time they went out.
Of course, I would do it only when the sky was blue.
And she would never answer him. And this went on for 2 months.
And then finally, she did consent to give me a color name, but it wasn't blue. It was white. For a few times she said white, and then finally after a month and a half or two more months, she said blue for the first time.
Wow.
But even then it wasn't consistently blue. So she said once blue, no white, no blue.
Did she eventually decide though, you know what, Dad, it is blue?
Well, no, she never said it this way, but eventually when I asked, it became consistently blue. So she just would say blue.
Okay.
This was for me really the point where I could, you know, convince myself, or convince at least my heart, that the sort of allegedly perfect example of blue is not
so perfect.
So, you know, for Homer, who, you know, never ever probably saw a blue object except the sky and the sea, never had a dad who sort of went on about blue objects and asking what the color of the sky was, the fact that he didn't lose sleep over it doesn't seem so strange anymore.
You know, now that I've heard this, I'm a little ruining the moment when Alma decided the sky was blue. Let her have whatever color she wants it to be. It doesn't have to be blue.
Weirdly, then, color is a loss of innocence.
Yeah.
It's like having something fixed that for a while is just between you and your frenzied heart, you know, just.
And the sky has many colors, truthfully. On the other hand, though, I'm disagreeing with myself now. If we all agree the sky is blue, then that's something we can share, that she can share.
And then she's in conversation.
And then eventually she'll understand, you know, this kind of blue.
Emma, you saw me standing.
Yeah, there aren't blue moons, but you know what one would, you know what it feels like.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a happy night.
Mm-hmm. Without a love,
our guardian star lost all his glow. The day that I lost you, he lost all his glitter. The day you said no, and his silver turned to blue. Like him, I am doubtful that your love is true. But if you decide to call on me, call me Mr. Blue.
I still think it's the most beautiful color.
Mm-hmm. I just took red just to be contrary. I'm trying to think what actually my favorite color is. I don't know.
When you say you love me,
Mr. Blue,
then prove it by going out on the sly, proving your love isn't true. Call me Mr. Blue.
I want to thank all the musicians who were so generous to let us use their music this hour and joined in our covers of the Rainbow Project. You heard Reggie Watts with Rainbow Connection, Barbara Bennery with Over the Rainbow, Lonesome Organist with Green Onions, Nymph with Brown Rice, Yellow Ostrich with Sound and Vision, Raya Brass Band with Paint It Black, Nico Muley with Big Yellow Taxi, Shearwater with Black is the Color, Eric Freelander with Blue in Green, Marcy Playground with Whiter Shade of Pale, The Heap with Mellow Yellow, Tao Win with Blue, Snowblink, you just heard, with Blue Moon, Dan Deacon right here with Colors, Busman's Holiday, Mr. Blue, and our very own Tim Howard, a.k.a. Soltero, performing Green River.
Well, take me back down a cool waterfall.
We'll be doing some cool things with these songs for the moment. Visit Radiolab.org.
Let me remember the things that I love.
Hello, Radio Lab. This is Guy Deutscher.
This is Brooke Watkins.
This is Jason McCroy. Here's the message.
Radio Lab is produced by, I don't know how to pronounce it,
Jade Abumrad.
Our staff includes Ellen Horn, Soren Wheeler,
Pat Walters, Tim Howard,
Brenna Farrell,
Len Levy,
Dylan Keefe,
Melissa O'Donnell, and Sean Cole.
With help from Douglas Keith Smith, Brendan McMullen, and Rafaela Benin.
Okay.
Special thanks to Sarah Montague,
Paul Heck, Nick Capodice,
Guy Levitt,
Ivan Zimmerman,
Aya Keith,
Judy Zhao,
Winter Woody,
Raga Guest Daughter,
and Carver Throdson.
Thanks, bye.
End of message.